Hi, I'm Amanda.
And I'm Rebecca, and this is Full Plate, Full Cup. We're startup leaders turned executive coaches who believe that you deserve to be wildly successful and wildly happy.
We interview trailblazing entrepreneurs, business leaders, and creatives so you can peek behind the curtain of how they got where they are today and start carving your own path towards success.
Each episode shares personal stories as well as actionable takeaways that you can apply to begin living a more joyful and fulfilling life.
Join us to learn how to scale your business, harness your power, and fill your cup.
If you like what you hear, subscribe, leave a review, and share with a friend. Thanks for listening.
Happy anniversary to us. So by the time you hear this episode, we will have officially been in business for one full year. It is so wild to think that it's only been a year and to see all we've accomplished in year one of Full Plate, Full Cup. So the reason we wanted to record this episode is to inspire those of you listening who might have a dream, a business idea, a career pivot, or something that you've been sitting on and maybe a little bit nervous about kicking off, to really show you how much is possible in just one year if you decide to go for it and really commit your heart and soul. So without further ado, we will be answering all of the questions you submitted about our first year in business, and we hope they are helpful to you as you build whatever it is that you are dreaming of. And I'll kick it over to Rebecca for question number one.
Thanks, Amanda, and thank you everyone for your questions. We're so excited to answer them. The first question is, what have you done to try to maintain work-life balance while starting a business? Or have you totally failed at it and just accepted that the first year is eat, sleep, work? So I can confirm for both Amanda and I, because we did talk about this beforehand, that the first year has not been eat, sleep, work. And in fact, we are on a mission to break the stigma that as a founder, you need to drop everything you're doing and devote your entire life, your entire self, your entire being to your business. We talk about this a lot in terms of work-life receptivity instead of work-life balance. And work-life receptivity really allows for the ebbs and flows of life, right? Some days you're going to be working on your business more than other days, and that may even go for longer periods of time, and that's okay. It's not about finding and maintaining this perfect balance. If you find yourself eat, sleep, work all the time, then you haven't really been strategic, right? You've spread yourself way too thin in terms of the number of things that you've agreed to, the number of business initiatives you have, or just your overall commitments in your life. Like, you literally can't do it all. I think it's an Oprah quote, right, Amanda? Correct me if I'm wrong, where she says, you can do it all, just not all at once. And that is really what we've been adhering to in this first year of business. So what I would encourage you to do is to make your own rules about what entrepreneurship can look like. Just because someone else has done it one way does not mean that you need to do it that way. The beauty of running your own business is that you get to decide what you commit to and what you don't commit to, how much time it takes, how much effort you're going to put into it. No one else will do that for you, right? If you want someone else to do that for you, stay working at a company, collect that steady paycheck, and clock out when you leave the office. You want your business to work for you. You don't want to totally work for your business. So three tactical things to help get you there, because Amanda and I always love leaving you
with a tip.
We love a tip. We love a trick, a tool, and a strategy. So the first is to get really clear on the number of things you can take on. So for us, for example, it's, you know, the number of calls, the number of clients, of courses, of podcast episodes that we are willing to take on in order to still have lives that light us up and to stay enthusiastic about our business. The second is to ruthlessly prioritize your whole life. And this really goes back to that idea of work-life receptivity, that it's all connected. So again, maybe there's a two-week period where you know it's going to be a heavy push for your business, and you need to say no to some things that you would normally say yes to. Let yourself do that. Conversely, maybe there's a two-week period where your business is a little bit slower and you now have the ability to say yes to more of those things that don't have to do with work. Give yourself permission to do that as well. The third tip is to get clear on your goals and make sure that what you are doing ladders up to those goals. So for example, if you are not selling a digital product, you do not need to be running digital ads. If you are selling a niche product, you do not need to go ham on creating a massive social following. If you want to maximize your take-home income that is in your pocket at the end of the year, you do not need a big team, right? Get clear on your goals, structure your business in a way that helps you meet those goals. Over to you, Amanda.
Yes, that was so thorough, as you often are, but that was a really thorough response. So the next question is, I'd love to hear about the number one burnout misconception. Is there something that people widely believe which needs to be debunked? So first of all, it's kind of interesting, and this ties into what Rebecca was saying. We did not set out to launch a business that was really focused on beating burnout. We launched Full Plate, Full Cup to help people be wildly happy and wildly successful, right? And what we found was that what was standing in the way for most people of both, well, maybe not success, but for sure happiness, was burnout. And so that's why we decided to launch our course From Burnt Out to Lit Up, and why we talk about this so much. It's almost like something that you want to like, it's like the first mountain that you want to like climb and get over in order to do all the other things, right? Step one, it's not the only step. So I would say the biggest misconception about burnout is that it is some mathematical equation, right? Like what you are doing is going to directly determine the amount of your burnout. And that is not always the case. Obviously, that is a factor, but burnout really is a nervous system issue. When your nervous system gets overloaded, you go into fight or flight or freeze, right? I won't go into all the signs of the nervous system because I think we all know what those different states feel like, right? And because we all have different nervous systems, we all have different amounts of tolerance for the number of hours we are working, the amount of stress we can withstand, the amount of sleep we need, right? Whether interpersonal things like workplace drama is going to trigger us more than a really tough assignment, right? Somebody could work on really tough, challenging assignments all day and totally not get burnt out. But as soon as there's like a workplace drama with a coworker, right, they go into super stress mode and they start to get really burnt out. So you need to get really clear on what you are doing, what your nervous system can handle, and not always assume that it's situational. And that's really what we go into in our course in like very nitty gritty detail. So if you are feeling burnt out, know that that is your truth, right? And it doesn't necessarily mean that it's your job, it's your boss, right? It's your nervous system. And you kind of need to peel back the layers a little bit and see which factors are the most contributing to that burnout.
Love it. Burnout and nervous system queen over there. So the next question is, what are your yes indicators? Was it a mutual feeling you both needed to have, or did you develop some objective criteria based on your mission, vision, or values? And before I answer this question, full disclosure, we did have to Google what a yes indicator is. So it turns out that it's an Excel function. DM us if I'm wrong on this, but it looks like it's an Excel function. It's been a minute since I used Excel. I was a finance major in college, fun fact, but Excel was never my thing. So we're going to interpret the answer to this question as, how do we decide what to do? Our yes indicators. All right. That being said, the first way that we decide what we want to do is by getting really clear on our goals. And I alluded to this earlier, but by getting clear on your goals, you create guardrails for what you say yes and no to, because if it doesn't support or align with your goals, it's an automatic no. The caveat to that is to not be afraid to pivot on your goals, especially in year one, when you are constantly, or you should constantly, be learning, iterating, and figuring things out, right? In year one, it's really hard to come up with objective criteria for your goals because you just don't know what's going to happen with your business. You don't even know who your customer is yet. You don't even know your voice yet. And so for us, our year one goal was strictly to build credibility. And we had some sub goals under that that were more metrics oriented. But at the end of the day, we just wanted to build credibility. And so that really informed how we ran the business. We didn't invest in any paid ads. We didn't invest in paid marketing. We didn't have aggressive funnels. We didn't have a lot of fancy equipment or tools or backend stuff. It was, how do we get our names and our voices out there in a way that makes us trusted thought leaders in the space? And so having a clear goal and then being willing to pivot on that goal is really, really important. The second is that we're very open and honest with each other. And if you are in the position where you are looking for a co-founder or have a co-founder, I cannot recommend enough finding someone where there is a mutual trust and respect and that you can argue in a healthy way with, right? Because you're not always going to be aligned. And in fact, you don't always want to be aligned, right? Otherwise, you would work by yourself, for yourself, and live in the world of you. The beauty of having a partner is that you have someone else's brain to lean on, but you want to be able to trust them and they to trust you, that together you'll come up with the best solution. Along those lines, you want to be willing to be proven wrong, right? If someone comes to you, if your partner comes to you with an idea and you don't believe in that idea, right? You can say, I get why this feels like a yes, and here's why we're not going to do it. Like, you want to allow yourself to vision together out loud, to dream out loud, but not to be attached to the outcome. And then our third yes indicator is realizing quickly that not every idea we love that feels like a yes can be actioned on, at least not right now. It goes back to that Oprah quote that I shared earlier, right? Especially in year one, when you're just starting out, when again, you're figuring out your voice, your audience, you're trying to grow some type of revenue, some things just need to be put on the back burner. And if you put them on the back burner, they may become more of a strong yes, or you may learn that it's actually a no, and thank goodness you didn't go for it earlier. So being patient and being willing to parking lot things is huge and will lead you to further yes indicators down the line.
Oh gosh, we have a massive parking lot.
It's huge.
I in particular have a very large parking lot. So next question, which has a few sub questions. So with you all a year in, how different or the same is being out on your own compared to what you thought it would be before you officially started? What surprised you? What's harder than you thought? And what's easier? I guess I'll start by saying being out on our own has been amazing. It's been really, really good.
It's true.
Not going to lie. This has been certainly professionally, I can say the best year of my life. I feel very utilized in all the ways that I want to be. And I hope you feel the same, Rebecca, very utilized professionally, you know?
Absolutely.
But, yeah. But just, you know, what's harder than maybe we thought is marketing. And, you know, marketing is hard, whether you are a one-man show. It is hard when you are a big global powerhouse like Nike, where Rebecca used to work, right? Like, I coach founders and executives. I advise a few startups, right? Everybody's racking their brain on marketing. We as humans these days have a very short attention span. It is very hard to get people to understand the value of what you are offering. It's hard to get them to pay attention. It's hard to get, you know, anyone to really like click on what you're doing, you know, let alone read an entire landing page, let alone pay for something, right? So, you know, just if you are an entrepreneur or if you're planning to be an entrepreneur, just kind of like know this going in. You could have the best product, the best idea, right? And it still is going to be hard to get people to realize that. It does get easier as time goes along, as you build that credibility, but just like expect it to be a challenge. That doesn't mean you need to throw a bunch of money at it. In fact, like at first, you don't want to do that because you don't know, as Rebecca said, like how to be efficient with your marketing. So just like, no, like marketing's a schlep for all of us. And in terms of what's easier, like doing it all, right? So Rebecca and I are a two-person team. We do everything. If you send an email to the business, one of us answers it, right? Like, you know, we don't have assistants. We don't have a social media coordinator. Like, that's us, you know? But it never feels like grunt work or overwhelming. And I think, you know, part of that is having both of us, but also because we really love, there's so much passion and excitement behind everything that we do. And I will just caveat to say that there is a limit to that, right? So we run a communication business, right? Our product is us talking. We don't have physical product. We don't have complex digital products. We don't have shipping, right? There's a lot of complexities that just aren't real in our business. So it is not realistic for every founder to be like, oh, I can do it all and not get totally burnt out and overwhelmed. We can because of the type of business that we created, where we are the product, right? Like, we're the product. As long as we wake up happy and energized, like, the business is running. So I say that, you know, we were able to do it all. It was easier than I thought it would be, but don't take that to say that you should also do it all, because that greatly depends on what type of product you're offering and, you know, how labor intensive your actual business is.
Absolutely. And then what surprised us, and this is going to sound so basic, you guys, but what surprised us was that we should just be ourselves. And what I mean by that is that when we first launched the business, I remember maybe 14 months ago, we had our first photo shoot and Amanda and I planned our outfits weeks in advance. We showed up in like blazers and turtlenecks and full hair and makeup that we, of course, did ourselves.
We wore heels.
I think I even had to literally buy heels for that shoot. Like, I don't own heels. I'm a sneakers girl. And we were like, we need to look professional as hell so people believe us and they believe our story and they believe our product. And the photos are beautiful. Like, dare I say, we look fabulous, Amanda. We look fierce. However, those photos don't reflect who we actually are, right? Like, we don't really wear makeup. We don't really do our hair. We're more of like t-shirts and leggings and roll around in the dirt kind of girls. And it got really exhausting to try to put on a facade of blazer style professionalism every single day, especially since Amanda said we essentially are a communications business. And so we are the product. And so when you are the product, right, to not be yourself, that gets really hard after a while. So we eventually just started leaning into who we are, showing up on social media platforms, kind of like roll out of bed and go style. Speaking how we normally speak, right? It's not always PG and that's okay. And what we found that really surprised me in particular, and Amanda, I think you, is that that's when people started to really connect with us and connect with our message, because people don't want to listen to folks who seem contrived or like they have everything together, when in reality, you know, that no one has their shit totally together. Right? People want to connect with real people who understand them. And so learning to be ourselves has been we know how to be ourselves, learning to show up as ourselves and be comfortable showing up as ourselves has been a huge surprise. And frankly, the results that it's driven for the business.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just like so much more fun because
way more fun. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And honestly, like going back to doing it all, I think if we were still trying to manicure everything perfectly, we would be exhausted of it by now. I can't imagine putting on makeup 365 days a year. Like,
I don't, my New York City closet isn't big enough for all that shit.
All the outfits, I know. So the next question is, what was the biggest mistake you've made in your first year and how did you learn from it? First of all, I will say that like, mistakes aren't really mistakes, right? They're learning opportunities, right? I have to caveat that. But we actually tried to launch a course about 3 weeks into being live as a business, like threw up our Instagram handle, threw up our website. And 3 weeks later, we're like, we've got a course.
LOL.
It was crickets. I mean, like full on crickets. And what's funny is we didn't really have too many hard feelings about it. Rebecca and I both have worked in various roles in marketing for like a combined 35 years. So we know what we're doing. We just got a little overeager and we literally within maybe even less than 2 weeks of having that landing page live, we were like, you know what? We're not ready for this. Let's pull this, right? Like, I don't even know if anyone will remember that we did that, because we had like 300 people on our email list, right? We had like, you know, like, nobody. We didn't have a community yet. So we weren't ready. And the only quote unquote mistake in that is that we did invest time, right? In building and thinking and ideating. But we ended up going back to the drawing board. We spent the next 9 to 10 months building our brand, growing our awareness, working with one-on-one clients, working with corporate clients, getting our social following up, getting our email following up. And about 10 months later, we decided to launch our burnout course, From Burnout to Lit Up. And it's gone so differently. Look, like, we aren't like, you know, one of those massive like growth marketing companies that's churning out thousands of people into our courses. But we had people sign up on day one. When we launched it, we had a handful of signups day one, more signups trickling in every time we did a marketing initiative. And we were like, okay, we are ready for this. Like we earned the right to get people to pay us for our course. And, you know, no paid advertising, no manipulative marketing, like you're not getting scary funnels from us. And so that felt really, really good. But the other thing I will say is the wireframe of the course that we made that we didn't launch, we ended up using for the course that we did launch. So I only add that detail in to say that, like, if you end up trying to do something that doesn't work, there might be raw material in there that you can repurpose that will work. It's not like you have to burn the whole thing down to the ground. But yeah, everybody has a few hits and everybody has a few misses. And we certainly have.
Yes. And all the ideas on the parking lot that never even saw the light of day, right? I think we had like a book club at some point. We had so much stuff that never ever happened. Lots. Maybe one day. The next question is, what should you invest in your first year in business when you are not necessarily making any money? So this really depends on the type of business you're running. Amanda mentioned earlier, there are some businesses that require physical inventory and shipping. And in that case, you are going to need to invest money upfront in order to even create your product, right? But what I think is kind of a universal truth about just getting started is to invest time to learn how to run your business and how to DIY different parts of your business using a minimum suite of tools to help run it, right? It is so tempting to outsource everything, especially when you look around, there's social media, there's other businesses, there's like conferences and thought leaders, and everyone seems to have these big, sexy businesses with big, sexy brands, and everything is perfect. And you're like, oh, I want that. But that costs money. And so when you're first starting out, DIY as much as possible. So for us, it was really investing in like the free to lowest tier levels of different tools. We use Squarespace, MailChimp, Canva, Zoom, Calendly, and then learning how to use those tools so that we can self-service as we run our business. And that's not to say that one day we won't outsource some of those things or upgrade or change the platforms that we're using, but for year one, our priority was, let's learn how to do this stuff ourselves. Let's run some experiments. Let's get really hands-on. So even if we do outsource them one day, we have the knowledge to say, hey, this is what works. This is what doesn't work. Here's how you can help support us. In the spirit of transparency, I do want to note three areas that we did outsource in year one and kind of why we did that. So first, we outsourced professional photos. We mentioned this earlier, but listen, you should have an amazing photo of yourself where you feel confident, where you feel like your knowledge shines through, where you feel like yourself. And that photo will take you so far, whether it's social media profile, LinkedIn, website, your bio for different events and conferences. It doesn't need to be expensive. Find a friend with a nice camera, pay them $50 to take a photo of you, pay someone random on Upwork $25 to edit it. And boom, you have a photo that will last you a really long time. The second thing we invested in was our Squarespace initial build. So we spent just under $6,000 for someone to create our website and in that to create a brand guide for us. After that was done, we've been managing Squarespace on our own, but that initial build was quite a big lift. And it having that in place also allows us to just kind of like copy paste pages whenever we make something new on Squarespace. So it provided this really beautiful foundation that has frankly saved us a lot of time and effort in the long run. And then the third thing that we outsourced was accounting. We are not accountants and we do not want to DIY this because we do not want the IRS coming after us. And so we have someone do our accounting at the end of every fiscal year. And they also help to set up systems in place so that year round, Amanda and I can track our revenue and our expenses in a way that, again, makes us compliant and sets us up for success in the long run. Hey, Full Plate, Full Cup fam. If you're building a business or you're about to build one, you need to check out Female Founder World. It's the place to meet your business besties online and in person. They host events all over the world with the biggest female founders.
Check out their free community at www.femalefounderworld.com. That's www.female FOUNDERWORLD.com to get access to the people, experiences, and the tools that you really need to build your dream business. Happy building! So the next question is, have you experienced any sexism or ageism in the last year while positioning yourselves as experts in the field? And I don't want to say I laugh when I saw this question, but I'm like, I'm going to be 40 in January, so I'm not young.
I'm 34.
Yeah. Okay. You count, but I'm not young anymore. So I have earned my age expertise, right? And look, I coach people that are older than me. I have clients who are like 15 to 20 years older than me. But, you know, I have enough years under my belt that anybody who had any sort of ageism towards me, I would almost like roll my eyes at them. When it comes to sexism, it's interesting. And I don't want to minimize the prevalence of sexism in professional settings. But for us, you know, coaching is a majority female, I think, still field coaching therapy, a lot of these sort of helping professions. So I do think that there is a little bit less of that just innately in the industry that we've chosen. However, a funny way that we've kind of experienced this is so many people assume that we only coach women or that we only work with female founders. I've even had clients say that about me. And what's crazy is like, both Rebecca and I, like when we set out on our own, our first client, both of us was a man. And we have consistently had, you know, male clients, male founded companies that we've gone in to do our workshops in our course, the people who have signed up for our course. It's a healthy mix of men and women. And while we know there are a lot of phenomenal companies out there that are by women for women, I mean, female founder world, you just heard about them in this episode, right? We totally believe in that. And I'll speak for myself personally. I think it's awesome when a successful, powerful man hires me to coach him on his business or hires Rebecca and I to come in to their office and teach something, right? Because that shows the lack of sexism, right? Hey, you guys are women and we want to learn from you. We respect you. We see you as experts in the field, right? So I think while, like I said, it is amazing that there are more opportunities by women and for women because we have been marginalized. We all know the stats that only 3% of venture capital goes toward women. That is still very real. And like, we're so happy to serve men and to show men that we know what we're talking about. We know our shit. And so, yeah, we've been fortunate in that regard, but not a lot of sexism or ageism. We push past all that stuff.
Totally. And what I'll add is if you are on like the younger side of, you know, your profession, to not be afraid to own your experience, right? Like, I'm 34. I still have 12 years of, or 15 years actually, of work experience, right? At startups, running my own businesses, at Fortune 500 companies. And I think a lot of times we tend to minimize the experience that we have, especially when we are younger, but like, own that shit, shout it from the rooftops, know that you are qualified, that you do have experience, and that you have put in the work to help people regardless of your relative ages. All right. The next question is, what has been your number one pushback / excuse as to why someone does not need or want your services? So we've been actually fortunate that we haven't received a lot of direct pushback or excuses why people do not need or want our services. But when we've found that there's a mismatch, it's generally because there hasn't been a product market fit. And it kind of goes back to those yes indicators that we jumped on things before we really knew who we are, what we offered, and even what our audience wanted. So Amanda talked earlier about how we launched a total flop of a course before launching From Burnout to Lit Up. Before launching From Burnout to Lit Up, we put out surveys, we tested content, we really like dipped our toe in the water to make sure that there was going to be a fit with our audience and that we were going to be giving our audience something that they actually needed and wanted rather than forcing our idea of what we wanted to do onto them. So I think that it's really, really important to make sure that there is that product market fit and to not be afraid to test and learn and iterate and pivot when necessary.
Sorry. So
short and sweet, baby.
Yeah, short and sweet. I love it. So we are going to kind of move into a little bit of rapid fire just because we have a couple of founder-oriented questions. So, all right. So we got three questions that are all about founders. So I'm going to answer all three of them in a little bit of a rapid fire way. So the first question is, what do you think scares founders the most? And I really have two things for this. One that is like a fear that we want to move through is how other people are perceiving them, right? The outside world, their investors, I think is like number one, their employees, their competitors, right? Becoming a founder, it like really puts you in a spotlight. And that can be really confronting to almost everyone. It can be really triggering to the nervous system. And so that's a lot of the work that, you know, we would do with our founder clients around like getting centered, like being able to put the blinders on a little bit and not worrying about what everyone in the outside world is thinking. And then at a core level, it's not being able to bring their vision to life in the way that it lives in their heart. And I think that is such a pure and motivational fear. I think that's like the fear of all humans in general on this earth, right? We want our lives to be a testament of our spirit. And so if you choose to invest your whole life in starting a business, it probably means, I mean, unless you're just like a serial entrepreneur and you're chasing the next big exit, the founders that we work with, they are looking to build something that means something, that makes a difference. And so, you know, that's like it's both a fear and a hope. And it's something that you can actually like work with and cultivate to come back to your why over and over. So what are the main traits that founders or leaders should have? I'm going to give a couple. So resilience, right? It can be a little bit of whack-a-mole when you are running a business. So you really have to develop tools to roll with the punches. Believing in yourself that you can figure stuff out. Rebecca talked about how like even, you know, some of the founders I coach are like in their 20s, right? They're 30 under 30 people. And not believing that you know everything, but believing that you have the competency and the intelligence to solve problems is so important. You do not have the time to be opinion shopping and asking every single person what to do. Nope. If you're the founder, you got to figure it out and help your team figure it out. Self-awareness. If you do not have self-awareness, you are going to be rubbing people the wrong way, left and right. And not that you need to change who you are to please others, but you can't be an asshole. If you're an asshole, if you're abrasive, if you're a total stress ball and you bring that energy to your team, to your vendors, to your investors, it's going to cause issues. It's going to hold you back in a way that it doesn't need to. Willingness to learn and be wrong. So just like you need to trust your ability to figure things out and be right, you also need to trust that you're not going to know everything and that sometimes someone on your team is going to be raising their hand and telling you something. Don't be a hard head. Don't be stubborn. And truly the number one trait that I think is foundational to be successful as a founder, but really like in life, is decisiveness. Being able to make a choice, believe in that choice, stick with that choice, and keep your blinders on, because you have to stick to something, right? Even if you make the wrong choice and eventually end up pivoting, the waffling, right? The delays, the indecisiveness, it makes people lose trust in you. It makes people lose trust in your business and it slows you down. And we all know in the startup world, you can't just, you know, you can't move slow. You got to be decisive. And the last founder question, I think I want to hear both of our answers on this. So what is the piece of advice that you have seen founders not listen to? So for me, it's definitely opinion shopping, which I mentioned earlier, which is, okay, you should have maybe three people. If you're making a decision and you really can't figure out the answer on your own, you ask your coach, you ask your mentor, you ask one trusted colleague, employee, you know, somebody in your field, and then you move forward, right? You don't ask every single person on your board, all of your founder friends, drop it in a Slack group, ask your boyfriend, ask your mom. Because guess what? When you end up with seven possible options, you're in a worse place than where you started. So don't opinion shop. It's very attractive, but it can be really destructive to your productivity.
The piece of advice that I often hear founders not listen to is to get started with what you have. I mentioned this earlier, but especially in the founder world, it can be so competitive. And that's both outwardly, but also internally, like you almost feel like it's you versus everyone else, because it can be a bit of like smoke and mirrors in the founder world. And so it can be discouraging to think, oh, I have a $5,000 budget to get this business off the ground. It doesn't look like what everyone else is doing, because how could it, because of my budget? And so I might as well not even try. Well, what I tell every founder or aspiring founder is to start somewhere, right? In the product world, there's this idea of an MVP, a minimum viable product. Launch a minimum viable product, or if you're still unsure, launch a minimum viable test, right? Just put something out there that allows you to get a feel for what works, what doesn't work, what you like, what you don't like, and then take it from there. So for example, I coach a lot of mid to senior level managers within businesses who want to start side hustles as consultants, and they feel a lot of pressure to get this off the ground in a way that's really compelling. What I tell them to do is to literally put together a PDF one pager in free Canva with their offerings and some pricing and email it to 20 people that they know and see what happens, right? Get started with what you have in a way that is low lift, low risk, low cost, and then take it step by step to figure it out from there. So we are done answering all of your questions. We hope that this episode gave you a bit of inspiration and hopefully some tools to go out there and build your dreams, start your business, get after that idea. And we also hope that we've shown you that it doesn't need to be expensive. You don't need to raise money. You don't need to go into debt in order to start your business, that literally you are enough, that what you have at your fingertips is enough. And with resilience and decisiveness, as Amanda said, hard work, imagination, and a willingness to pivot, that you really can make anything happen. If you have any other questions, you now know that it literally is us on the other end of those emails and those DMs. So reach out to us at yes@fullplatefullcup.com. Follow us on Instagram @FullPlatefulCup. Find us on LinkedIn, Full Plate Full Cup. We are everywhere strategically in those three places. And we would love to hear from you and love to help you and encourage you on your business journey, because we truly believe that you deserve to be wildly successful and wildly happy. And we are here for all of it. Amen.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Full Plate Full Cup. If you found this episode helpful, please make sure to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with a friend.
To learn more about the Full Plate Full Cup methodology or to work with us in a more personal way, find us on Instagram @FullPlateFullCup. That's @FullPlateFullCup or online at www.FullPlateFullCup.com. www.FullPlateFullCup.com.